This podcast is brought to you by Versity. Versity is an organization that provides blood to hospitals in the Midwest, including Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Ohio. While all of us are familiar with blood donation, we may not know how it really helps people or how safe it is right now. Most of us are focused on managing life in a new world, but there are still people going through medical events who require blood. People undergoing cancer treatments, those with chronic health conditions, or someone having a baby may require blood, and we can help. Donating blood is always safe. Centers are regulated and required to follow medical guidelines that safeguard the donor and staff. Since coronavirus hit, additional standards have been put in place. Also, donating blood is an essential service, so you can go even if you have restrictions in your state. And we need blood. High school and college closures alone deplete donations by 20%, and each of us who donates can save 3 lives with 1 pint of blood. So, in a time where we all need a little hope, reach out and help someone by donating. In Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Ohio, go to versity.org and schedule an appointment. Outside of those areas, go to your local blood bank. Again, that's Versity, VersiTi.org, and schedule your appointment today. This episode of the Mighty Parenting Podcast is sponsored by SaveTheChildren.org. Save the Children believes that every child deserves to have a future, and in the United States and around the world, they are working every day to give children a healthy start in life, the opportunity to learn, and to be protected from harm. They deliver lasting results for millions of children, including those who are hardest to reach. They do whatever it takes for children, every day, and in times of crisis, transforming their lives in the future we share. Right now, coronavirus is the biggest global health crisis of our lifetime, and it threatens children in every way. COVID-19 has already left many children without caregivers, out of school, and exposed to violence and exploitation. Child poverty is rising during this time. With your support, we can help children in unsafe households and help support distance learning in the face of school closures. So here are some ways that our support can make a difference. We can donate anywhere from $5 to $50 and help vulnerable children. Just a couple of ways that that can help is as little as $5 can provide a nutritious breakfast and lunch for a child who usually relies on school for their food. And donation of $50 can deliver essentials that keep kids learning while they're out of school, things like books and activities and supplies. And there are many more ways that our small contributions can come together to help these children. If you'd like to learn more or make a donation, go to savethechildren.org/savekids. That's www.savethechildren.org/savekids.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm Sandy Fowler, stress relief coach, emotional wellness speaker, and host of the Mighty Parenting podcast. I am also the co-founder of MightyParenting.com and want to encourage you to go there to get more. Get the email series on communicating with your teen. Get a link to our Facebook group to get more support. Get things that you can use on your parenting journey. Thank you for joining me here today as we learn about body positivity. And as I was getting ready for the show, I started thinking about the people in my life, my friends, my family, acquaintances, and even strangers, because people talk to you about the weirdest things, especially if you're on the playground with your kids or something. But I realized that you rarely find someone who's truly happy with their body. You know, often there's just a general dislike, but even those people who meet the ideal have something that they're unhappy with. You know, I remember seeing an Oprah episode many, many years ago where they were discussing photoshopping of images, and there was a supermodel on the show, and she was saying that the magazines photoshopped her body. So they actually changed her body shape. And I was just sitting back and thinking about that and going, apparently even a supermodel isn't good enough to be on a magazine cover. No wonder the rest of us have problems. Well, today we have two experts here to help us with those problems so that hopefully we can prevent our kids from having them, or if they already do, help them move through it and past it. So we're going to have a conversation with Zoe Bisbing and Leslie Block. And Zoe and Leslie are both adolescent eating disorder psychotherapists. They're also mothers of two, or actually in Zoe's case, two and a half, based in New York. And they met in graduate school. They bonded over their dedication to the treatment of eating disorders and body image concerns, and have now come together to create the Full Bloom Project, where they're sharing resources for parents to help them transform their home environments into a place where children can naturally boost their immunity to our appearance-obsessed culture and channel their precious resources toward more meaningful purpose. So Zoe, Leslie, welcome to Mighty Parenting.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, we're excited to have a conversation today.
Yeah, I love that we're going to be, I guess, dealing with this, right? I wouldn't say it's the elephant in the room. I'd say it's kind of the opposite, because it's not that people won't talk about it. It's that we've accepted this as just being status quo. It's part of the culture. It's kind of almost the way it should be, in a sense. And so I appreciate that you guys, who are mothers and therapists, you're dedicated to this treatment of eating disorders and body image concerns. And I know that you understand our worries as parents, plus you have the experience and tools to help our kids. So that is very much appreciated. So what I was kind of wondering is, because you work in this area, what are you seeing? Like, what is happening with our teens and tweens and 20-somethings in terms of body image?
Yeah, well, we're seeing kind of a snowball type effect of, like what you said, this is the water we swim in, the air we breathe. We call it diet culture. And we see that it's growing in terms of, you know, our kids are struggling with this just like we did, our generation and the generation before us. Not much has really changed in that realm, although we are seeing attempts at change in this kind of category of body positivity that teens are getting exposed to, mostly through social media and some advertising. Some of it's doing, some of it's helpful, and some of it is kind of just bringing diet culture in, bringing body positivity into diet culture, or, you know, culture wrapping around this word and taking it as its own and not really helping. So we see teens and people and their young people and also adults as well, who just really are confused about how to be in their bodies and go live their life.
So what does that look like in our teens? If they're struggling with body image, if they're are not able to manage these messages we get, what might that look like in their thoughts or their behaviors? Or
there's definitely, excuse me, there's definitely a continuum of what that looks like. I mean, if we start from sort of the most extreme and then work backwards, you know, it can look like a severe eating disorder where somebody is in need of, whether it's to see me in my practice or Leslie in her practice, or even needs to be hospitalized or sent to a residential facility because their capacity to sort of function and eat regularly and nourish their bodies without compensatory behaviors, which is sort of just a fancy way of saying, you know, using things like purging or exercising excessively to kind of compensate for what they ate, you know, on this sort of extreme side of the spectrum, you have real eating disorders that people might recognize these diagnoses, like anorexia or bulimia or binge eating. And I should say there, even on the extreme end, where we're talking about like psychopathology that is in need of diagnosis and treatment, that can look all sorts of different ways. Like a lot of us have an idea that someone with an eating disorder is like an emaciated woman. And in reality, there are people in bigger bodies that are struggling with acute anorexia, but because of a lot of what maybe we can talk more about today, things like weight stigma sort of hold them back from getting treated in the way that they need to be treated. So that's sort of the extreme, like where body image concerns and eating difficulties literally take someone out of their life. Like they have to prioritize treatment over living because like life literally has to stop until you can eat and function. And then maybe as you sort of move towards the unfortunately, quote, normal side of the spectrum, you have this like normative discontent where you have people that kind of like what you were saying, Sandy, at the beginning, just don't feel good about their bodies. And sort of what Leslie was alluding to, talking about us all living in diet culture, when people aren't feeling like they're good enough as they are, they take in these messages about what they should be eating, when they should be eating, what they shouldn't be eating, things of this nature, and start to put a lot of their time and energy into trying to change or, quote, fix their bodies, and think about all the resources that we have in terms of time and money that could be sucked into that pursuit. And it sort of pulls even higher functioning people out of their most meaningful life, where rather than taking on a cause that they care about or, you know, socializing with friends, they may be lost in some kind of diet cycle or just negative body image thought cycle, which can be really, really a bummer, like to put it lightly. And so I'm sort of giving you the example of like the kind of most extreme and then what we sort of most maybe typically see, but even the people that are struggling in that more quote typical way, they're missing out on living a life in, they're missing out in living life in a free, liberated kind of way.
Well, and I know you guys talk about that, and that's where you actually kind of came up with that name of Full Bloom. So we want people to be able to put their energy into living a great life, into the things that they're passionate about, not focusing on the food and managing our bodies. And is that something that you see impacting teenagers too? Because as you were talking, you know, I tend to think of it in terms of adults, but you guys also talk to teens or 20 somethings as, you know, college students or kids who've moved out of mom and dad's there. Is that happening to them too, where they're just putting all their energy into that?
Yeah, I mean, it looks something like our kids, you know, from a young age start to develop this sense of what's valued in, and we kind of model that for them in our home environment. And also school teaches them a lot about that. And it starts to get a bit confusing, and their peers, right? So it starts to get a bit confusing when the peers are starting to be more important figures in what's being determined as valuable. You know, towards in middle school, this is when kids tend to start to lean on their peers a lot more for opinions. And that's when there's a lot of risk. This is also the time at which kids' bodies are changing a lot because of puberty and the beginning stages of that. And so kids are starting to try to figure out, okay, what is valuable for me to be investing in their own thoughts, right? They're not actually thinking that thought. They're just moving in that direction kind of subconsciously. And when we're giving them, when they're starting to attend to, particularly right now with social media, and there's Snapchat and there's filters that help you look a certain way, it just makes these, how you look and what you're eating and all these messages, really potent. And kids start to try to navigate through that in middle school, through high school, and then leaving the home, like truly leaving the home environment and moving into a college dormitory or a new apartment. You know, this is, they're continuing to try to figure out what's valuable. And in body positivity, you know, we really want to avoid kids falling into this place of, the way I eat and the way my body looks is extra valuable. Because that is kind of the, when we think about an eating disorder or any kind of movement towards body dissatisfaction, it really starts with that becoming like a really bigger value than it really needs to be out there in the world in people's health and happiness. So people start to kind of, let's say, like fall into that trap starting in middle school. And then it starts to look like, well, you know, I'm going to just eat the super healthy way, and I'm going to start going to the gym. And it seems really, for a lot of parents, it seems really exciting to see their kid making decisions that seem to be, that, you know, valued and helpful for their health and happiness. And some of them really are. But then we start to see that that's being invested in beyond like their true interests and their true socializing, networking relationships. And we really want to keep an eye on that as parents, of kind of, okay, can we make sure that this, we think about it as like a pie slice. Can we make sure that this like really takes up about 10% of their pie of life? And not more than that, because when we get into more than that, that's when we get really nervous about what else kids have going on for them.
So an indication of a problem, even if a kid is choosing healthy activities, the indication of a problem there would be if it's consuming too much of their life?
I think that's fair to say. I mean, the pie slice comes, that Leslie's referencing, you know, it comes directly from an intervention in eating disorder treatment. We find it really applicable to prevention efforts and just kind of keeping your eye as a parent on your kid's well-being. So yeah, it's one thing to see your kid eating, you know, a balanced diet and loving to move and maybe playing on sports teams and having an active life. Like, that's wonderful. But when you start to see things like they're eating so, quote, healthy that then you go on vacation and they're having trouble picking off of a different menu because there's sort of a rigidity around the, quote, healthy eating. Or similarly with movement, that they're having trouble taking a day off or 2 weeks off, or that it's all they can talk about, or that they're so kind of into their identity as a, quote, healthy eater or athlete that they're sort of losing social connections. This happens, and sometimes it's hard to notice, but that would be an example of like, well, that pie slice is starting to look more like 75% as opposed to a more appropriate 10 to 15.
Yeah, so kind of the amount of time it's taking up, their rigidity around letting go of things, those sound like indicators that we can look for as parents to go, hey, this might be a time that we need to intervene in some way. What would be a healthy way to intervene to help our kids?
Well, I think it starts from, you know, we on our podcast interview kind of experts studying this question, and we always ask them this question really from a place of like prevention. So how do we intervene today that helps us not have to intervene later, because this is what we know in terms of the spectrum, is that the sooner we intervene, the better. And the interventions that we can do on a preventative side are the most powerful, ultimately. So with that, we really, as parents, want to get associated with our own relationship with our bodies, so that we can be mindful of not sending messages that there's something going on that's not okay with our body, which is challenging, but for most people, because again, like, this general body dissatisfaction exists in parents just as much as teenagers. But we want to start with not talking about bodies so much. You'll notice that it happens a lot that people make little comments very regularly that are about, oh, I'm going to go to the gym tomorrow after you ate dinner at a restaurant, or while you're at a restaurant, or something. What's one that you hear a lot, Zoe or Sandy?
Yeah. Like, oh, you look great. You lost weight. Or, oh my gosh, you look great. What have you been doing? Have you been working out? Like, these are really very, you know, innocent comments that people make all the time. And, you know, we have small children, like, this, it's hard to stop our own selves from saying, oh, you look so cute, or look how pretty. And girls sort of get a little bit more of this attention than boys. There's a little bit of higher risk factor for them. But these are examples of ways in which we're talking to each other as adults, to our teens, to our preteens, to our babies, you know, just sort of commenting on appearance in a way that does over time send this message to our children and our teens, and then ultimately us as adults, that this really matters, that it really matters. And of course, you know, I remember, a couple years ago, my dog died, and it was like a big loss for our family. And I was grieving, and my appetite was nil, and I lost weight. And the positive compliments that came my way were like, it was like, wow, you look great. What are you doing? And it's like, grief? Like, I'm miserable, you know? And so these comments, they come at you all the time. And they, you know, we offer them as ways of being kind and connecting. But to Leslie's point, these, based in the research, because most of the guests that are researchers that come on, this is one of their most popular places to start, which is, we have to, before we can stop talking about bodies, we have to notice that we're doing it. But then we have to make a concerted effort to start talking about something else, be more intrinsic qualities rather than appearance, because it's really, really common to sort of obsess over this, even just, you know, casually.
And we've had, from different angles, we've also heard that on our podcast, is when it comes to our kids, we want to focus our conversations. And you brought up the example of compliment. Oh, you know, they come out, you look so cute, or that looks so pretty on you, or your hair looks so good. We want to focus those compliments on things like their effort, their kindness, their curiosity, maybe an achievement, but those more intrinsic values about a person, not absolutely about the container which holds the person.
Absolutely. Right. And a lot of people kind of move into body positivity thinking, well, if I'm giving more compliments, then that might help, which we find ultimately that no comments on the body helps the most, just nothing, you know, no positive, no negative, no really talking about it, but talking about these other things that we truly want our kids to learn from us, we really value in them, because any positive reinforcement feels so good. It feels so good to every human being. And so if you're getting it through your body and the way that it looks, that's where you're going to keep going. It's like you're a mouse and you're going to keep pressing that lever until you realize that that lever is causing problems for you, which it takes a while, right? So we want to kind of train our kids from the beginning that the way that you get positive reinforcement is through these more core values. And that's the way that we give the positive reinforcement and the compliments.
Well, and Leslie, you said it here, and I know both of you have said it and alluded to earlier, is the things we talk about with our kids show them what's valued. Mm-hmm. And so by just not even going there, by actually thinking, okay, what is valued in our household? What do I think is important in life? And focusing our conversations that way, I think it also helps then too, because it's not about what we can't do. It's looking at, okay, what can I do? And the more we're focusing our conversations on the values and adding in, there just won't be room for the other pieces. So it's not right. So much that we, for me at least, that's the way I see it. I don't necessarily so much have to consciously go, oh, I need to keep watching myself and stop. Yes, I do want to become aware of when I say that. And I'm going to put 90% of my focus on how can I add value-based compliments, conversations, and questions to my conversations with my child.
Yeah. What we can do versus what we shouldn't do or should stop doing. I do think that this is where kind of the second fundamental of our work comes in, because one of many people's core values is health. And so we've had to help families think about that in a way that's body positive, or body neutral, or body liberated, which are two other terms that we've learned we really need to introduce to our audience, because most people, it's too far of a leap to go from body dissatisfaction to body positivity. And it's more relatable to go through this kind of body neutrality or just free of the body conversation versus body positive. So I'm throwing those out there, but to get to this conversation around health, and that unfortunately because of diet culture and because of the beliefs that are very entrenched in our society that people in larger bodies are not healthy or are lazy or are not taking good care of their life, which are things that I do not believe, but are very core beliefs that have been perpetuated by our media and advertising, because it's very effective, that people have this kind of overlay to the core value of health that is, well, if my body is thinner or smaller, then they must be healthier. So that's the way to access health. And this is a real challenge and a dilemma for our whole culture, but for parents and particularly for teenagers who are just trying to figure this out without as much knowledge as we have, that health is, we can really not tell someone's state of health by the way that they look. And that is challenging for most people, because most people have a core assumption that we can. And this is where we kind of invite our listeners to deep dive into the field of health at every size, which is a whole field and many podcasts that can be found on it, including some of ours. But really, this is we have to start from that understanding when we're looking at that core value within most people of health, that doesn't mean that the body needs to look a certain way or needs to kind of constantly be striving for a little bit, those 5 extra pounds, you know, like if I just lost 5 extra pounds, I'd probably be healthier. And we really don't see that like working itself out in the research, but it just is a very, very core belief in most people.
And this is an interesting tie-in too, because many people are concerned about health. There is a bit of an eating revolution going on, and that takes a lot of time. I know we are part of that. We 2 years ago, we changed to a whole foods diet and a whole bunch of other choices that we made for health reasons. We had a couple people in our family who were dealing with some issues, and this is what was recommended by our doctor, was, you know, head this direction. And it can take an incredible amount of time and thought to switch the way that you eat, to start cooking whole foods when that's something you haven't done before. And one of the things you guys are kind of warning us against is, oh, how much time are you spend thinking about what you eat and getting into that kind of, you didn't use the word punish, but it's the only one's kind of had to kind of punishing yourself for eating the wrong thing or whatever. So what do you recommend when a family is making healthy changes to their diet for good reason? How can we prevent that from turning into a problem where our kids are having this overtake their thought processes, or where parents are having it overtake their life?
Yeah, it's an enormous question. It's a good question. And my initial response is to be a little bit broad brushstroke, and then maybe we can figure out a way to answer the question, like, how do you actually talk about this with your kids? The recommendation from a doctor that somehow you can control your health exclusively by changing your diet, it's not entirely, it doesn't entirely hold up. And it's for multifaceted reasons. Now, I want to preface this by saying nobody, neither Leslie nor myself, are vilifying a whole foods plant-based diet. You know, I mean, families have a right to make choices. Individuals have a right to make choices. What we like to do is sort of shine light on the nuance, which I think your question is definitely begging. The problem here is, what we then start to take away is, oh, it's up to me. I just change my diet and I can change my health. But part of what is tricky, and this is where we really love the Health at Every Size paradigm for thinking about this, is diet and even movement are really just a small part of what goes into someone's overall health portrait. You have things like genetics. You have things like social determinants of health, like access. A family with privilege, with more privilege than another family, may have better access to not just healthcare, but like making the switch to more of this whole foods diet that you're describing. And so there's a lot of disparities, and we don't need to get so much into the weeds, but for people that are interested, we have tons of resources and they just exist to learn more about what the research says about social determinants of health. But even if you think about something like genetics, I've had conversations with people who really do believe that their health is in their hands, and if they just work hard enough with exercise and changing their diet and eating really, quote, clean, that they'll reduce their chances of XYZ, negative poor health outcome. And it's not to say that that's entirely flawed, but it's taking on a whole lot of responsibility that may not be your responsibility to take on, because we have things like, for example, weight stigma that make it really hard for people to, one, have a positive relationship with food and eating and have a positive relationship with themselves. And we are finding in research that actually weight stigma is a much higher connector to poor health outcomes than even what size you are. And I guess the last thing I'll say in the broad brushstroke is one of the biggest problems of sort of radically changing the way you eat, whether you're an individual or as a family, unless you're paying attention to the nuance, we can never lose our capacity to eat what we like to borrow from other people and call play foods or fun foods, and what we like to call junk food in mainstream society or processed foods, that moving into a place where you're starting to vilify certain foods and glorify other foods for morality purposes or what, you know, quote, health purposes, starts to become really problematic, because being able to eat chips and cake with friends and grab slices of pizza, you know, at 2 a.m. in college, these are things that we want people to understand are really healthy, because even though the nutritional excellence of the you know, kale salad is higher than the nutritional excellence of the Domino's pizza, we're looking for the social connection component and the sort of behavior around eating. And the irony is that the more, quote, healthy eating we focus on, we often see a lot of even binge eating on the foods that we're starting to think we shouldn't have.
Well, what's interesting to me there, Zoe, is it ties into what you said before. At least what I'm getting from it is what we have to watch out for is still kind of the time, the attention, the thought process around it. So like with our family, the changes that we made, some lifestyle changes, we made some diet changes, it did impact the health, you know, things improved, markers came up, but it isn't, as you were saying, this totally restrictive, no, we can't have pizza. It's like, this is what we buy to have in the house for our regular meals. Sometimes we'll go, hey, we want ice cream, you know, and someone's like, well, I'll pay if you drive. And, or when we're out with somebody else, we're not going to say, nope, we can't go to that restaurant or whatever, because these, we're not talking about food allergies where someone's life is in danger. You know, we're talking about, as you said, health issues, which are impacted by many things, including that social factor that you mentioned. Being able to be social is important. And so if I caught what you said correctly, what we'd want to be doing as a parent is going, okay, so our family is choosing to do this, but be watching our responses and our kids' responses and our thinking about it and how much of our time and effort is being put into that. And if it's to the detriment of other important parts of our life, is that kind of a reasonable opinion? And there was more there too, but I'm kind of trying to pull out and go, as a parent, okay, yeah, if I'm watching my teenager or I'm watching myself, you know, what do I do? How do I know if this is actually a problem? How do I keep it from becoming a problem? And it seems like it's kind of, how much do you value it? Don't make this the most important thing in your life. Don't turn this into your God, you know, the God of nutrition. Mm-hmm. But to keep it in its place. And if we find ourselves struggling, because we're talking about teens and 20 somethings, I think that's a conversation we can have with them too. Hey guys, I noticed that since we did this, I'm finding myself kind of obsessing about this. What are your thoughts? Yeah. And they'll pull you down off the wall. I mean, they'll say, yeah, mom, you're making me nuts.
It's true. It's true. Often kids notice that, you know, before parents can be real with themselves, you know?
I think I would just, yes, the answer to your question is yes. Like, that's a great distillation. I would take it one step further, and this gets more into the practical and the concrete. We optimally don't want any household to eliminate any kind of food. So even if you're making this concerted effort, like you were saying, to switch over into more of a whole food, you know, kind of plant-based lifestyle, we literally want to, we do want to encourage families to still keep Oreos in the house, to still bring out some of those foods that maybe you're on one hand making a concerted effort to move away from, but we don't want to lose the presence of those foods in the house, because you're right. Like, being able to talk about it, especially with teens and certainly young adults, is awesome. And that's where we're at an advantage, right? We do a lot of talking to parents of younger children where we're trying to kind of set the stage so that, you know, they're sort of primed early on. But yes, absolutely. Like, the conversation that you're just modeling is awesome. But we we don't want there to be, well, back up. We want homes to offer equal availability and equal morality around the different kinds of foods. Because it's one thing to talk the talk, but you kind of need to walk the walk. So if you eliminate all, you know, snacky foods from your house, or you replace them all with the sort of quote healthy version from your local health food store, you're sending a message that there's something wrong with some of these other foods that our kids are interacting with in the world. And we want our kids to have a no big deal attitude about some of those more quote forbidden foods, you know, which can happen simultaneous to even this kind of lifestyle change that you're describing. But this is where we want to sort of model the gray area as opposed to the black and white. So I hope that adds a little bit.
I want to just add some of our reasoning behind what Zoe's kind of describing, which is kind of in terms of if our listeners and your listeners need help with this, it's really kind of moving into this conversation about intuitive eating and how to actually do that, which is which most people need a lot of help around. But the reason why we are really strong advocates around learning how to move into that place for you and your family is because of all the weight science that we have come to understand, which is that for most people, 95% of people is actually the statistic that I can reliably say, changes like this, drastic changes that are really, really focused on weight loss. And we kind of have to sit and ask ourselves, is that what we're going for? Because if we are going for these changes, to have that be either a byproduct or the actual product, the truth is, in the weight science, that 95% of the time, that is not sustainable. And the 5% of the time that it is comes with this over-evaluation and time and resources and many times clinical eating disorders. So we kind of stop. We want to kind of start with that and stop with that in terms of, these changes are very, very popular right now in so many different ways and have been for a long time. It's just evolved when we look at it in our culture into this now more wellness culture versus diet culture, because there has been so much research and because most people can say the term diets don't work and maybe believe part of it and hope that there's some other thing that will work, and that other thing has become this wellness thing. And what we're learning consistently over and over again when we research this is that we cannot, they're not sustainable for most people. So what ends up happening is that someone who might introduce this into their household ends up struggling with some of these restraints or restrictions and ends up being challenged by having a child want to have ice cream in the home and having trouble themselves with the ice cream in the home. And that causes actually a real challenge. It takes people away from their ability to intuitively eat. And we want that for people. We want to hold on to that. We want that for people. We want to teach people how to do that again so that they can actually have the health outcomes that we see time and time again come with that approach to eating. And we have to, again, kind of take out the weight from the conversation and from the motivation for people. So I just think it's really important for us to be able to introduce this idea of intuitive eating into kind of our foundation of body positivity, because it becomes a really, this conversation about the actual food that's being put in becomes such a big conversation, and whenever we talk about it, it becomes a thing that people like attach to, because there's so much information out there about nutrition itself, and we want people to continue to think about that big circle and that pie and know that, like, let's not spend more than 10% of our day thinking about this, please, because our health relies so much more on that other 90% of our life.
And so intuitive eating is huge. And, you know, we're approaching all of this more from this weight side and eating disorder side of things. So we do need to, I believe, put in the caveat that some people have health issues. I have a family member with chronic kidney disease. If he does not follow the diet his doctors gave him, he will die. You know, we have to follow certain food restrictions, or, you know, people who have an anaphylactic allergic reaction to a food. They cannot eat that food. So I just want parents to keep in mind that I am sure that Zoe and Leslie, and certainly not I, are saying never, ever, ever restrict a food. Mm-hmm. But to take that step back and go, what am I restricting? Why am I doing that? For the general population, what we want is to have a good, healthy relationship with food and learn to eat intuitively, which could you, one of you please quickly give us a definition for that before we wrap up? Because I'm sure some parents are going, well, what do you mean by eat intuitively? Because quite frankly, if I'm just going with what I want to eat in this moment, it's always going to be ice cream and Oreos. Mm-hmm.
I think, well, first of all, Sandy, I just want to, you know, second what you're saying. For there are sections of the population, like those two family members you mentioned, that have true medical reasons for why there are specific restrictions. But I think part of what you're also acknowledging is that for the general population, this is a more nuanced matter. And yet we have a big part of the population that don't fall into the folks that you're describing, that have like the real kidney issue, the real allergy, the real celiac disease, right? Who are sort of lost and looking almost to the protocol people that you're describing are on to say, oh, well, that something like that must be the way to optimize my own health. And that's where we're missing the nuance. But I'm glad you made that point. And in terms of the question, what is intuitive eating? You know, I can certainly read you a little kind of quote about it, but then I think most importantly, we can leave your listeners with actual resources that they can go through podcasts and books to really read about it. But an intuitive eater is a person who makes food choices without experiencing guilt or an ethical dilemma, and who honors their hunger, respects their fullness, and enjoys the pleasure of eating. And what I'll say about that definition is that, and Leslie alluded to this, this is really hard for people to do because we live in a culture where there are so many sources of food police and rules, and we're all mixed up with what's, you know, can I have this? Can't I have this? That it's a very common answer, like you said, Sandy, for someone to say, well, if I was really left to my own devices, I'd just eat ice cream all day. When in reality, and this is the intuitive eating journey that we're really just introducing your listeners to, is one in which you can get to back to a place where, by trusting your body's internal wisdom, again, through a process, depending on how far removed you may be from that capacity to eat intuitively, you will be able to eat ice cream in a way that feels good in your body and not feels guilty or, makes you overly full.
So thank you so much for giving us the definition of intuitive eating, because it is, I really love it, and it made me feel better because that's really kind of where we've gotten to with the changes that we made, and not 100% and not all the time. And there are some still, you know, some struggles around some of the sugar foods, because there's that addictive nature to it, at least that some of my family experiences. But like you said, you know, that's the journey and there's a destination and families need to find their way there. But summing up, what I love what you guys shared, which is let's make food be, you know, let's make our goal be intuitive eating, and let's keep an eye out for if food is appears to be taking up too much time, if our kids are getting really dogmatic about it, or it seems like they can't eat without having some kind of repercussion around that. Those are signs that we need to get involved, that we need to start talking to them, find out what's going on, and possibly get help. And I know you guys have so much, and it's all on your website, which of course we'll put links to your website and your podcast, but could you just share your website with our listeners for anyone who wants to find more from you?
Sure. So our website is www.fullbloomproject.com. And on that website, you can connect to our podcast. You can also find our podcast where you get your podcasts. It's the Full Bloom Podcast. And on our website, there are lots of resources. And also through the show notes in our podcast, you can connect to even more resources, which I'm sure you offer as well.
Yes. Yes. So thank you both for sharing and enlightening us here today around our food and our eating.
You are welcome. Thanks for having us on.
And thank you, Mighty Parents, for being here. If you like the podcast, please rate, review, and share it. And as I said, remember to go to mightyparenting.com, get your free resource on communicating with your teen. And thank you for joining us, for being part of the Mighty Parenting community. Remember that you are a mighty parent, so you've got this. And I will see you next week.